This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
I am excited to introduce our final speaker of our conference, Dr. Yao Du, who is Clinical Assistant Professor in Otolaryngology, Head and Neck Surgery at the Keck School of Medicine at the University of Southern California. Dr. Du is a speech and language pathologist who works in multiple sites, including schools, hospitals, skilled nursing facilities, and home health. She also provides consultation about digital diagnostic and assistive technology tools for children and adults with disabilities. Dr. Du conducts research that bridges the gap between speech language pathology and human-computer interaction through the design and evaluation of web, mobile and web technology for people with communication and cognitive disorders. Dr. Du will address a topic that has been in the forefront for many of us, generative AI, risks and benefits for people with intellectual and or developmental disabilities. Please welcome Dr. Du.
Hi, everyone. My name is Yao Du. I'm a current speech-language pathology clinical assistant professor at USC in the School of Medicine. I have the great pleasure of speaking today regarding my experience working with digital technology and generative AI. Specifically, I'll be talking about my own line of research in the past 10 years or so, as well as some of the risks and benefits I've seen for some future food for thoughts. So a little bit about myself. I'm an American Speech Language Hearing Association certified speech language pathologist. It is mouthful, so we typically call it SLP. I received my clinical training at SJSU, which is in the Bay Area, and my master degree program from UT Austin, which has a bilingual specific program. And my doctorate program is a different program. It's called Informatics at UC Irvine. And I also hold an advanced telehealth coordinator certificate from University of Delaware. Currently at USC, I run the Health, Educational, and Assistive Technology Lab. My research interest focuses on bridging the gap between speech pathology and how humans interact with computers. And in the Bay Area, I know a lot of people who work in technology often heard about the term UX designer and researchers. A lot of those colleagues or professionals study in the similar program and training like what I studied in my doctorate training. Specifically, I combine technology to design and evaluate assistive tech as well as telehealth service delivery. A little fun fact about my multicultural background, I speak Mandarin English. I'm also a first generation college student and first generation immigrant from China, and English is my second language. So today I want to start my talk by just sharing about how I came to study technology as a clinician. So if you go to the website of my doctorate program at UC Irvine, this is what you read from the website. Informatics is a window into this dynamic relationship, examining the interplay of people and technology and what it means for our collective future. I was very fortunate to study under my PhD advisor, Professor Katie Salen, who is a game designer. And I saw earlier there were discussions and questions related to games. And this was part of my research interest as well. I like to connect the dots between how children learn language, how they play and communicate with other people, as well as the technology that we can build and design and implement to benefit the future generations. So without no further ado, I want to share the clinical side of my previous experience. So this is a photo from picture collage from one of the private school I used to work at as an SLP. The picture on the left, as you can see here, has one of my elementary schooler client with autism. We were doing floor-based play. And a lot of what we were doing daily is to just sit on the floor, engage in whatever is client-centered, interest-driven activity to elicit language. The picture on the bottom, as you can see right here, I'm working with a middle schooler with a dual diagnosis of autism and ADHD. So specifically, we were actually, I don't know if you can see the computer screen very well. We were going on Google Image and trying to look at his favorite type of pizza flavor and toppings, trying to grab that picture from Google Image and also put that image in the PowerPoint slide so he can present for his English class. So this is my day-to-day activity. Besides doing assessment, I teach via instructional technology and educational technology. I provide treatment via game-based and learning-based materials and some therapy applications, and we have a lot of fun. And at that time, I also do work with children who have complex communication needs, and that made me wonder, how can my clients in the special education classroom not benefiting the similar level of technology that I'm reading in research papers? That was also a question that really made a lot of key stakeholders around these children wondering where are we at in terms of technology. So just to give you a few statistical pool examples, we have talked about children with different types of communication needs, and we talked about my role as an SLP and some of the technologists I work with, like designers and developers. Looking at this happy face in between, we feel like everyone have this kind of constant question about where does technology take us and how are we envisioning the future and what should we care about? So American Speech Language Training Association have released several different polls, and these are data backtracked 10 years ago. So 70% of parents reported in the ASHA member poll that they feel they need more education about safe use of technology. And our association also did surveys with technologists. So they did it at the Consumer Electronics Show back in 2017. This is one of the biggest and largest technology conference in Las Vegas every year, and that's when they announce cool, fancy technologies across the different industry leaders. And back in 2017, the CES attendees were saying that we need more research to look at the impact of the technology they develop, because sometimes when they release the technology, they didn't really have the bandwidth and the knowledge to follow up what has the technology impacted or influenced the user. And lastly, as speech language pathologists, the community also feel that health professionals are obligated to teach, to prompt, and reinforce the safe technology use, and this should be a priority for health professional. So, given all these background needs and interest, I like to highlight some of the learning outcomes in my short 30-minute talk. In this next 20 minutes or so, I like to share some of my personal journey witnessing the advancement and improvement of these digital technology and give you some teasers and previews of the future advancement and potentials that these technologies can take us to. And I'll wrap up with some discussions on risk and benefits. So before we start, let's take a pop quiz. If you do have your ChatGPT and you feel like you wanted to ask ChatGPT for this question, go for it. So here are three very famous people: Ed Sheeran, Temple Grandin, and Stephen Hawking. Do you know what type of communication impairments or communication disorders they have? I'll pause for about 30 seconds and see if you want to quickly look that up or ask your ChatGPT. And you are more than welcome to leave your comments in the chat. Okay, so before I reveal the answer, I'd like to take you back to introduce you some of the key scope of practice by American Speech Language Hearing Association, or ASHA, for us as speech pathologists. So here we go. So ASHA defines nine specific scope of practice, and these are kind of the guiding practices we provide services for our client. Ed Sheeran stuttered as a child. So in case you don't know, this would be the service he's gonna receive. He will receive intervention related to fluency. Temple Grandin has autism, and this impacted her ability to engage in social communication with other people. So that comes under the social aspect of communication of our intervention services. And lastly, Dr. Stephen Hawking has ALS, even though his condition is neurodegenerative, it did end up impacting his total communication modalities, including like use of gestures and his verbal speech. So his communication modalities are the specific speech generating system he ended up using, which is what the computer you see always in his photos and videos and even movies or show he is participating in. We call those augmentative alternative communication system, or AAC. So let's check and see if your ChatGPT gave you the proper answer. So Ed Sheeran, we work with him on fluency. And Temple Grandin, we work on social communication. And Stephen Hawking, we work on using various communication modalities to support any meaningful communication. Just a little caveat, Dr. Hawking at his late stage of life, he is unable to use his eye tracking system anymore because of his muscle degeneration. So his last ability to use AAC system is through one of his cheek muscle that actually allows him to provide access methodology to activate his communication system. So speaking of all of these individuals, I want you to kind of come back and imagine what can we do for young Ed Sheeran, young Temple Grandin, and younger version of Stephen Hawking. And this leads us to some surprising statistics about communication disorders. And if you don't know, communication disorders is considered one of the most common and least diagnosed disability of childhood by primary care providers. And it can impact between 5% to 12% of young children. And oftentimes for children with different type of developmental or intellectual disabilities, we see speech therapy as a important service and very functional to develop academic and social communication skills. In my earlier days working with children with communication disorders as a speech therapist, I really witnessed the whole digital evolution in my own experience through my clients. So let me just give you how everything kind of started. Back in the days, I started work with some of my clients in the pre-mobile era. I go to intervention and I work with them using toys, books, board games, and this is kind of as much as you name it. This engaged children in the type of play we call physical play. So if I bring in a toy, or even if I bring in worksheets, there are tangible things they can look at and they can write or they can draw. And in 2010, things have changed drastically. So the first mobile tablet, Apple iPad, was released, and I immediately bought one and started using it for my clients. Fast forward 7 years, a survey actually done by researchers at Cal State East Bay indicated that 60% of SOPs are using iPads for therapy. So this adoption rate really led to a saturation of a lot of apps, and parents and other stakeholders, teachers are all asking, is there an app for this? Is there an app for that? And as a researcher, at that time, I started to look into the plethora of stakeholders involved in app use, because that's also the time when we hear concerns about this technology. And one of the key terms that arises is screen time. What if we spend too much time in front of these screens? And that wasn't a concern 10, 20 years ago. So working with my advisor and then later my own students and my research collaborators, we published a plethora of journals, papers. And as you can see from these journal titles, some of these papers are geared towards child computer researchers. Others are towards like educating parents or clinicians. And research methodologies we used include a variety of qualitative and quantitative methodology, including interviewing clinicians about what apps are you using, how to use them. Also interviewing other app designers and developers, how do you even make the apps? And also we even went on app stores and look at the reviews people left on individual apps and talking about their concerns related to usability and content and et cetera. So, really quickly recap some of the key findings on this topic. We found some influential factors for using technology are related to the financial constraints. Some of these AAC apps, I'm talking about speech generating systems that the students with minimal or no verbal communication would rely on to communicate, can cost up to hundreds of dollars. But clinicians also do use these free apps like games, and these are all nested in the same iPad while working for children. However, there's some challenges we must acknowledge. Multilingual offerings and content, as well as information related to marginalized communities and it's not inclusive and not culturally linguistically sensitive, has been brought up multiple times. And you can read more about the quotes that we learned from these app store reviews related to the speech therapy apps or the AAC apps here on the slide. Just in general, there's a long way to go to make these applications truly inclusive for individuals with disability. We also learned some insights to educate clinicians and designers. And clinicians share that they do use a plethora of activities because sometimes just doing therapies is not fun. And instead of clinicians engaging, the games really provide the intrinsic motivation and the dynamic flow to keep the therapy going on top of the learning experience. So clinicians do have very creative use of the games. And then designers and developers also offer some really good insights because oftentimes when we create technology, it's difficult and challenging to include these individuals with disability in the conversation. They can't even answer or, you know, participate in interviews. So how do you make sure their voices are included? They are part of the participatory design process, so they can always give input for technologists to iterate on their design, become a very important concern for these technologists. So to wrap up something we learned from the app design and concerns, this kind of feels like an initial taste of how the digital technology has invaded our life and created a drastic change. But my story didn't just stop here. Let's go back to kind of how things have evolved after the app days. So after the iPad or tablet-based adoption and intervention, we noticed, and I also noticed in 2014, the technology are not only giving touch-based interaction, but voice-based interaction. In 2014, I bought my first Amazon smart speaker, and I wasn't anticipating that 10 years later, the smart home technology are in more than half of US homes. And this means young children are not only touching the iPads, they're talking to their Alexa, their Siri, the Google, whatnot. And these voice assistants brought a drastic change to how we perceive communication, especially from the angle of speech language pathology. So for those of you who don't know Alexa or don't use Alexa specifically, I want to give you a little short demo of how this technology works. If you think about an Alexa skill as an app on your phone that makes your phone smarter, Alexa skill kind of makes Alexa more skillful. So one of my favorite kind of genre of Alexa skill is called voice toy skill. So essentially, in speech therapy, I may engage in vocal play and role play, all kinds of different play with children. However, on Alexa, this can feel very different. And specifically, I like to share some of these audio clips of Alexa. And this gives you a better understanding of how you may kind of capitalize on the smart home technology if you are already having these in the home setting. So the first clip I'm going to play is called Pikachu Talk. And here is a short clip. Let me make sure I get my mouse onto this correctly. And this skill specifically allows any vocal play to trigger a Pikachu voice.
Alexa, play Pikachu Talk.
Okay, here's Pikachu Talk.
Pika, Pika!
Pikachu!
Pika,
Pika! Pika!
Pikachu!
Pikachu!
Pika,
Pika!
Pika, Pika!
Pikachu!
Pika, Pika, Pika!
Anyways, you get what this game is about. You don't have to even say human speech. It's gonna just generate a variety of vocal play, and it's different prosody and tone, and it's super fun. And here is another game called Animal Sound. And specifically, you can almost treat Alexa as like a game master.
Alexa, play animal sounds.
Ahoy there. What animal sound would you like to hear?
Lion.
Here comes a lion sound. What animal sound would you like to hear now?
Cow.
Here comes a cow sound. Would you like a random animal sound?
Yes.
Here comes a cockatiel sound.
Alexa, play Pikachu talk.
Okay.
Alexa.
So you got the sense of how these Alexa skills really can just really become another talking intelligence in the home. And parents have written books and clinicians have blogged about how these type of voice assistants can benefit children in their speech therapy session or for their own children. I just wanna read a quote from this book by Judith Newman, a mom who has a son with autism. In page 131 of her book, she stated that Siri, she doesn't let my communication impaired son get away with anything. My son's practice conversation with Siri is translating into more facility with actual humans. So just by talking and asking Siri questions after questions, this mother noticed that never ending and never exhausted conversation communication can truly happen with these intelligent assistants. And I just want to quickly share a few examples of how my research team were able to engage in the functional use of Alexa, especially during challenging times for therapy. So during COVID-19, basically every single clinician is turned to a teletherapist overnight. And my research team noticed that a lot of our clients do have Alexa in the home, which is something we wouldn't think about. And we capitalize on these voice assistants in the home setting. So by actually creating lesson plans and therapy goals, integrating these Alexa games that I just showed you, we can teach the clients various skills about initiating conversation, modulating their volume and pace during conversation. And I want to show you an example slide PowerPoint. This is a telehealth PowerPoint we're using trying to teach a child. This is your Alexa, and this is how you say open the skill, a story or a song or a game, just like how you normally would open via your gesture or your picture-aided communication system to open doors. It's the similar concept to open that same Alexa skill. And our clients really loved it. And this just directly facilitated generation of the skill in the home setting. So just to wrap up, and I know I haven't gotten into the most exciting part, but my journey started pre-mobile, now into the first Apple iPad and the smart home speaker that allows children to not only touch, but speak to technology. And what's exciting is 2022, I myself spent my whole Christmas playing with ChatGPT. It's an initial start for me to explore artificial intelligence and large language models. And this is what our clients and our children and their parents are probably using at home. And this is not the first time that this technology will publish in research, but I just wanna give you the whole potential that how this can be so pervasive as a ubiquitous computing technology or anything that can be possibly supported with AI. For instance, we can have these tangible toys or human robots or child-specific toys integrating with these conversational agents behind or inside the toy. We can have apps that have AI-powered backend, and we may also have additional integration of these AI to support existing communication breakdowns behind these conversational agents and voice assistants. So the sky is the limit, but there are also some challenges. However, my team have done some initial exploration to look at the opportunities first. For clinicians, some of our biggest struggle was how can we have as many novel, personalized activities and also not being extremely burned out to look for these therapy materials and make them our own. My wonderful clinical partner, Lori Price, and I have collaborated with educational researchers, Dr. Lubnitsky. We wrote about how clinicians can use ChatGPT to create these therapy materials like stories, sentences to target intervention. And I also published a short, tiny paper that has a more extensive table with the support from a AI researcher, Felix Su at Meta. We wrote about the possibilities of not using text-based generative AI materials. Instead, we can have images, videos, songs created for our clients and their family members so that there are more resources and activities to do at home so that parents don't have to worry about how can I support my child in the home setting and with more accessible and affordable tools and assistance. So to kind of wrap up my last few slides, I want to challenge each one of you and think what I'm thinking right now and how we can use technology to further better our futuristic clinicians to support more individuals with complex communication needs. And let's think about Dr. Hawking and a specific use case of an individual, a child who may need an AAC system to communicate, but maybe a younger child cannot read and write. This child may need to look at pictures and create a lot of these visual scene display. Guess what? AI is able to help you generate as many scenes as possible, as long as you upload a picture or create imagery, self avatar of the child. We can take the child to a space, to anywhere he or she desires to go. And another use case, imagine the younger version of Dr. Temple Grandin or another young girl with autism struggling to learn social emotions. And my collaborators and I have designed a app-based tool, and it's powered by AI-driven learning content. It allows children to create personalized avatars, generates automatic conversations and activities to learn about these complex emotions. So if you're interested in reading more about this paper, I have included the citations here. And I want to kind of like hold everyone from being super excited about some of these technologies I'm showing and talk about the real challenges we still trying to solve as of now. Given these opportunities, my students right now working at Los Angeles Unified School Districts are not largely adopting these digital or AI tools. One of the biggest struggles we're facing is initially, at least when I started working as a clinician, there were a lot of one-on-one client, clinician, individualized therapy. Nowadays, my students are seeing more and more one clinician versus many student group therapy. This is due to the increased caseload of students being placed in special education services and speech therapy. So when we think about these technology can personalize or adapt to individual needs, now how do we even actually make that still scalable considering that there are multiple children with different types of disabilities in one therapy group and the clinician becomes the person, the only leader leading the whole session, satisfying and meeting all the needs and therapy goals for that session. It is very challenging to balance that tension between personalization and scalability. And secondly, thinking about documentation and paperwork, some of the AI documentation and summary tools I've explored still have accuracy issues, and also a lot of the current clinical practices using these AI tools are not following the best privacy practices. So when we deal with these multimodal text, audio, or video data, automation has become a very understudied area given all these constraints. And then third, I want to highlight, even though a lot of these mobile or assistive technology tools has been able to have more AI integration, And our electronic medical record are also becoming more AI powered and supported. These tools are still not communicating with each other. And as a direct consequence of that is whatever the AI summary or insights that I'm getting from my documentation, it's not directly being fed into the system or the technology I'm using with that individual client. And this miscommunication or disconnection has become a challenge, and it has been a historical problem across all the health information technology research, and we're still waiting for a better solution. And lastly, thinking about the stigma and the lack of resources when it comes to adopting new technology, my personal stance on this has been AI literacy is very important, not only just for the parents and caregivers, healthcare providers and teachers and all the other stakeholders, as well as policymakers, we all need to have a say on AI literacy, because the technology advancement is going really fast and it's improving every single day. And one day we're not following or we're falling behind, especially in the low resource schools, we are seeing the children being the children being left behind and receiving less equitable services. I know my 30 minutes end up really quick, and I really enjoyed my ability to my opportunity today to speak about my line of research. I do want to thank all of my students, my clinical partners, my research collaborators, and also the amazing families and the teachers I've been working with over the years, exploring technology and the excitement of the technology together. In closing, I want to challenge you all with this title that I put on the slide. Whether or not you are coming from different clinical or technical or personal background with these children with complex communication needs, I want to challenge you to think, can you build a better future for our children so that they can all become better communicators via these digital and AI tools? And if you want to continue to engage in that conversation and keep the dialogue going, I left my LinkedIn here as well as my email, and I love to hear from each one of you. And thank you so much for your attention for my talk.
Thank you so much for offering so many possibilities with technologies that in fact have been already introduced or are about to be introduced in the near or distant future. Especially, thank you for your advocacy and support for people with language disabilities and sort of considering equity in all of this. And I kind of thinking that I can summarize all of this in one word, which is hope, but that we do need to stay involved or be involved in all of this, which is probably means collaboration would be key among all of us in our different venues and disciplines. So let's see, I don't think there are, I didn't see any Q&As, but definitely some comments. I think people have just been very impressed with your presentation. And so my own question is this, which is, you know, you mentioned participatory design process, and you know, how do we make sure that that people who will be the users are included in the development of new technology and applications? Is there enough momentum to make sure that that happens, or is that something that someone or all of us have to sort of keep an eye on?
That's a really great question. Thank you so much for that wonderful question. So in clinical research or medicine, we follow the medical model, and oftentimes there's a gold standard based on large-scale clinical trial. And there has been a different mindset in looking at how we work with people, not just children in general, is to look at the social model of individuals through a more client or child-centered way. And this has challenged. So the design community really implement a child-centered design, meaning like even though the gold standard in medicine is we run a large scale clinical trial, that design by itself is is running into potential of marginalizing certain individual groups and communities. So in design research, we see these small case studies, individual workshops with just very few sample size of N, it's still being appreciated. Because oftentimes, if you look at large scale participants, you drop some of the people who didn't perform very well and they become the outliers. Those minorities or individuals' voices are never heard. And this happens often in the disability population. So just to answer your question, to make everything participatory is we really amplifying these people's voice. That's the center of what's driving our research. And this typically involves working with the children and their parents and their families, and then really look at what their needs are rather than what the medical question is. And this is also a great place where multiple disciplines may run into tension, like whose voice matter the most. But I say we do person-centered care in medicine. So we should really also look at different ways of examining how can we truly put the children or the patients at the center of our decision-making, even starting from a very simple, small sample size of one.
Well, thank you so very much. And that's an apt apt set of words actually to end our conference, because you know we are here for our clients, our patients, the people that we care about.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.